Okay, so I've got a fair bit that I need to go through. I have to justify the title of this talk, which is Marxism versus Anarcho-Communism on Smashing the State, which means I have to talk a little bit about the Marxist theory of how to smash the state, as well as anarchism's critique of Marxism. And I do want to emphasize anarchism isn't just a critique of capitalism, it's also a critique of Marxism. And that's really how it was developed, I would argue. I want to explain what that critique is. I want to critique the critique, and then I want to talk a little bit about how it's all played out in practice over history. It's a fair amount to get through, so we'll get started. And it means there'll be lots to argue about and debate in the discussion afterwards. So, starting with Marx's theory of the state, right? So when Marx, I say Marx, Marx and his collaborator Engels and their supporters, the first Marxists, when they began debating how to reorganize society, they weren't the first people to debate that. There were a few radical ideas already in play, and they're all actually still relevant today. So understanding how Marxism related to them is important. In particular, there were people, various currents of liberals and Democrats who, for different reasons and with different proposals, wanted to perfect the state. There were lots of imperfections about the state to point to in 19th century Europe: restrictions on voting rights, corruption, the inherited power of monarchies and the nobility, and things like that. And so liberals and Democrats, among other things, agreed that their mission was to make the state more perfect, to make it what it should be, to make it really liberal or really democratic, or both. And you could be more or less conservative if it was your approach. But generally, if you're a Democrat, you were more on the left of the movement. It meant you thought the state should be perfected in a way that would increase the influence and the participation of the poor. But everyone really wanted to perfect the state, make it look like society in a really different way. Then there were socialists who argued that you should fix what was called the social question, which basically meant economic questions, things that, like what we would now call under the umbrella of poverty, inequality, peasants, the urban poor, not having enough wealth to get by. That was the social question. And if you thought that needed to be fixed as part of the reform or the transformation, you were a socialist. And they weren't actually necessarily very radical or militant or interested in class struggle. A lot of them are cranks. And one of the most influential socialists at the time was Proudhon. And his position was quite hostile to working class struggle, hostile to strikes in particular. He thought socialism would mean creating a society of worker cooperatives, peasant communes, no class struggle, no revolution necessarily, but money lending schemes that would allow this to flourish and everyone could enter into free trade contracts with each other, with no exploitation. And that's how you're going to solve the social question for Proudhon. And it makes sense, actually, when you think about it, that a lot of self-described socialists wouldn't have liked class struggle, because they saw socialism, it meant, universal harmony, everyone getting along, looking after each other, not being self-interested. And, from their point of view as reformers, when workers struck, when there was class struggle, they were self-interested. It was bringing disunity, disharmony in society. And that's not what you want if you want socialism, a more mature way of organizing society. And then there was this not very well defined idea of being communist, which meant solving the social question through a really radical, confrontational way, probably abolish private property, probably have some kind of really extreme left state that acted on behalf of the poorest, sweeping away the rich, reforming the economy radically, basically the French Revolution in the most extreme way on behalf of the poorest. That would be a way of what many people who call themselves communists thought. Now, where do Marx and Engels fit in to all of this? Well, they began calling themselves Democrats, moved to calling themselves communists, but they began by actually by criticizing all of these ideas. Marx's early works were actually attacks on the idea that you could perfect the state for any reason. He was very clear on this. Any bureaucratic state couldn't bring human freedom, he argued, because if you've got this bureaucracy, right, it's the state over and above society, and it says we, the bureaucracy of the state, have to take charge of politics. Well, politics means anything that affects society as a whole. So if you have the state taking charge of politics, then that means everyone else in their day-to-day lives is, to use the language of the time, alienated from it. You can't be truly free because you can't participate in that collective organizing of society on a grand scale. So if you have that state taking responsibility for politics, then humanity as a whole loses that capacity, that freedom to collectively take part in making those decisions. And in fact, Marx argued the more perfect you make a state, the more legitimate it seems for the state to take charge of politics, the more alienated we might be in our daily life, because the more we, have to accept that it's really legitimate for the state, this perfect state, to take all power to organize society away from us. So Marx, Engels wanted a society where people can really freely, collectively decide what happened. Liberals and Democrats wanted to perfect the state, and even some communists did, but for Marx, that was a big problem. So what was the alternative? Well, this is where the class struggle comes in. Really early, 1842, Engels, I think, is 22 years old. Engels is in Britain and he sees this massive wave of strikes by factory workers. They're fighting the cops, they're organizing self-defense, and he writes on it for a magazine that a lot of these people were involved in. And he basically argues this worker strike gives us a sense of what the next revolution is going to look like. It's going to be factory workers taking revolution to the next level because they're going to attack the capitalists in these new big factories that are basically pretty new development in society at the time. Workers collectively organizing through class struggle to overthrow the capitalists and reorganize society from the bottom up. It's going to make the French Revolution look like child's play, basically. He said only a forcible abolition of the existing unnatural conditions, a radical overthrow of the nobility, and he said the industrial aristocracy, meaning capitalists, you know, the so-called aristocrats that are in industry, that own factories, only this can improve the material conditions of proletarians. He went on to say that revolution is going to be social, not political. He meant a social revolution, meaning transforming the way the economy is organized, right? So class struggle is going to transform economic life. It's not going to perfect the state. Meanwhile, Marx in Germany, he's looking at similar uprisings of working class people, weavers in particular, and he comes to similar conclusions, but he develops it a bit more. He says, yep, the new working class, they're going to lead a social revolution through their own organization on a big scale. And you think about this question, should we have a social revolution, meaning change the economy through class struggle, or a political revolution, meaning take on the bigger picture, political questions, democracy, whatever. The Marx says all revolution is a political act. It's overthrowing the existing ruling power and dissolving the old order. But he says without revolution, socialism can't be made possible. So basically he's saying we need to be political. We need a revolution that takes up every question, that challenges the old order on every front, reorganizes all of society. But we also need a social revolution, transforming that whole economic basis of society through class struggle. Now, around this time, Marx criticizes Proudhon. Proudhon has this whole thing opposing workers combining in what they call associations. It's like a trade union going on strike. And also Proudhon was very hostile to politics, taking up political questions. Marx writes on these so-called associations, trade unions, and he's really interested in it. And in his critique of Proudhon, he says, the first aim of resistance was just the maintenance of wages. But combinations, unions, constitute themselves into groups as the capitalists in their turn unite for the purpose of repression. And in the face of united capital, maintaining the association becomes more necessary than just wages. English economists are amazed when they see workers sacrificing part of their wages in favor of associations. In the eyes of the economists, those associations are just for wages. In this struggle, Marx says, a veritable civil war, all the elements necessary for the coming battle and development has reached this point. Association takes on a political character. He's saying as the working class gather together their organizations, have to confront the capitalists who are themselves united, then it also takes on a political character because you have to confront the question, well, the bosses as a class are organized thus, workers as a class. This isn't just me in my factory fighting over wages. This is about how all of society is organized and what power is going to rule. So this is where Marx is coming up with his theory of what he calls all the elements necessary for the coming battle emerging out of class struggle. Now, I won't go through the whole theory of Marxism. They've got a theory of history, all this stuff, you know, ideology, all kinds of stuff. But just in terms of the state, their argument is socialism has to come from class struggle, from the modern working class. It has to be political in the sense that the workers have got to try to take power, think about how all of society is organized, solve every social problem, not just wages in their own factory. But they're not going to do it by perfecting the existing state. They've got to smash it and replace it with institutions, their own associations, Marx is talking about. So what does it look like? That's pretty general. What does it really look like? Well, only a few years after this, there was a revolution all through Europe, the 1848 revolution. It combined struggling for democratic reforms and also class struggle. And there were new revolutionary governments that installed themselves, led by liberals and Democrats, that said, you know, they were going to perfect the state, make it more liberal, more democratic. But then they argued that the class struggle had to end. And it all ended in horrible disaster. The working class were repressed by these new liberal governments, democratic governments. Afterwards, Marx wrote a very famous and delivered a very famous speech to communists about what this all meant. And I think from that, you get the clearest, I think it's quite a remarkable passage, an account of what workers organizing to achieve both a political and a social revolution looks like. And Marx said, when a revolution happens, right, and the old regime falls, and then you get a new official government that's trying to perfect the state, make it more legitimate. Marx says, quote, alongside the new official government, they, the workers, must simultaneously establish their own revolutionary workers' governments in the form of local executive committees and councils or workers' clubs or committees, so that the bourgeois democratic governments not only immediately lose the support of the workers, but find themselves from the very beginning threatened by authorities, that is the workers' committees, behind which stand the whole mass of the workers. The workers must be armed and organized. The whole proletariat must be armed. Workers have to try to organize themselves independently with elected leaders and their own elected general staff. They have to try to place themselves not under the, this is, and he's talking about workers' militias, not under the orders of the state authority, but of the revolutionary local councils set up by the workers. So that's Marx's idea of how a revolution has to develop to have an independent authority of the working class organized through their own committees to supervise, threaten, and ultimately take power over the liberal so-called democratic capitalist state. Class struggle, you know, not meaning, you know, a minority fighting for the workers, but meaning the workers organizing themselves, trade unions, socialist parties, what in Marx's day they usually call clubs and associations, and ultimately through revolutionary councils. They combine social and political concerns, gather the whole working class up together so that they can act collectively, but it's organized from the ground up. And it doesn't happen instantly, it has to happen over time through struggle. What it isn't is instituting a new bureaucratic state, and it certainly isn't taking over the existing state and trying to use it on behalf of the workers. That's very clear. Marx complained, in his words, that the previous revolutions had only focused on perfecting the state machine instead of breaking it. So I reckon if you sum up Marx's theory of socialist revolution and his contribution and angles and their supporters to the socialist movement, it's saying workers have to lead a socialist revolution. They have to do it through organizing themselves to take power as a class. And I would add, it has to be international. Why? Well, for the same reason, only the modern working class can achieve socialism, right? For Marxists, workers are part of a new type of economy, capitalism. We have the big factories, the integrated economy spans the whole world. You can't liberate that piecemeal. You can't take over your own assembly line and say that it's socialist. You can't take over your own office cubicle or your little desk at the call center and say this is a socialist desk. You can't take over a national economy either and say that's socialist. It's a unique about the modern working class. They can only be liberated if they're all liberated, by liberating all of humanity. So instead of national states, Marx's theory of revolution is about a global workers' revolution. And that's why, you know, Marx is so associated with that phrase, workers of the world unite, from the very earliest times of Marxism. That is the slogan. It has to be international. Okay. Now, one thing you got to know, those rousing words I quoted from Marx about, you know, workers have to organize themselves in their own committees and all that, I did not find a very receptive audience in the 1850s, because those revolutions I talked about in 1848, they were badly defeated. And it was very demoralizing and depressing for socialists and radicals and the workers. And most of the radical movement turned against class struggle and against political combat in the period that follows. So Marx was in a minority in this time. People thought fighting for democracy and the right to vote was a big mistake. Class struggle was dangerous. And the dominant currents for a whole period were people inspired by Proudhon, who called themselves mutualists. And they focused on trying to peacefully organize workers' co-ops and renounce politics largely. And there were also a lot of trade unionists who said workers shouldn't get involved in politics. Then there were state socialists who tried to get support for their schemes, even from conservatives or monarchies or whatever. And Marx's approach of that class struggle, revolutionary internationalism, was really sidelined. But Marx, Engels, their supporters, they set up an international forum to try to promote those ideas and strategies in the workers' movement and the socialist movement. It's called the First International. That's how people call it now, International Working Men's Association. And it was in that international forum that modern anarchism got born in opposition to Marx. And the leader was Bakunin. People probably will have heard of Mikhail Bakunin, a Russian socialist who later would call himself an anarchist. So he organized the biggest opposition to Marxism in the International, and he took up the labels for it over time, anti-authoritarian and then anarchist. And then he ultimately broke away to create what he called an anti-authoritarian international. It really became the founding conference of modern anarchism. So all these people that would become really influential leaders in anarchism into the future, not just Bakunin, but also people like Malatesta, the Italian anarchist, attended as a young man, and a bunch of other influential people. So that's why I want to focus on Bakunin and his international as representing sort of the anarchist critique of Marxism. So what are the critiques? Well, here's what we against Marx, Bakunin and his followers argued, I would say, three things. Number one, there's nothing special about the working class. In fact, they're probably worse than other classes. Number two, that we shouldn't try to seize power or take up politics. And number three, that we shouldn't organize on a big scale, but through decentralized small groups, individualism, or little autonomous groups of the smaller number of people, the better, doing their own thing. Now, I just want to assess that really as a strategy. Firstly, on the working class, I'll quote Bakunin when he attacks Marx. He said, talking about who anarchists favor instead of the Marxist focus on the working class, Bakunin said, here's a quote, "The great mass, the uncultivated, the disinherited, the miserable, the illiterates, that eternal meat on which governments thrive, the great rabble of the people, the underdogs, the dregs of society, designated by Marx and Engels in the contemptuous phrase lumpen proletariat, I have in mind the riffraff, the rabble, unpolluted," he says, "by bourgeois civilization." So the idea is workers, as he would put it, are polluted by bourgeois civilization. And we need to look on the fringes, the margins of society, the outsiders, the most radical. And this is a massive, anyone who's been around anarchists today knows this idea has not gone away. It is a massive influence on contemporary anarchists and has been ever since. It sounds anti-elitist. It's like, I'm for the underdog. But actually, when you think through it, it's really privileging. The idea is there's a minority of outsiders who really see things clearly, not polluted by bourgeois civilization. And so there's this long tradition, not just now, but going all the way back to the origins of anarchism being associated with deliberately, you know, work is a crime, to quote an anarchist poster I saw on down the road from my house the other day. Work is a crime, living in squats, engaging in crime as a way to make a living, terrorism, contempt for the mass of workers. So that was part one of Bakunin's critique. Part two, politics and power. When they had their conference founding the movement, they passed a set of principles that said, quote, "The proletariat, if it wishes to take power, would itself become a ruling exploiter class. The political power is the first duty of the proletariat. Any organization whatsoever of a self-styled revolutionary political authority can be nothing but another fraud." Now, rejecting the working class ties into rejecting politics, because the idea is there's nothing special about workers. Anyone in power will exploit other people. That's just human nature, right? It's nothing to do with class or exploitation. It's just human nature. Anyone in power will be an exploiting ruling class. And anarchists have to fight then against workers trying to take power. That's principle two. Principle three, decentralization. To quote that founding conference, "Nobody has the right to deprive autonomous federations and sections of the incontrovertible right to decide for themselves and to follow the line of political conduct they deem best." Anarchists still go on and on and on about this under the principle of federation, they call it, or autonomy. Socialism, it applies both to the vision of socialism and also to their vision of socialist organization. Under socialism, you want lots of little market units forming contracts with each other, not humanity as a whole making collective decisions. So there's a group called the Sydney Anarcho-Communists, or they were called, I don't know the name, but at the time that they were called the Sydney Anarcho-Communists, they put out a zine where they had their statement of principles, their analysis of anarchism, and they said, they quoted Proudhon extensively, and in particular, they quoted his vision of a future society. "In place of laws, we'll put contracts. No more laws voted by a majority, or even unanimously. Each citizen, each commune or corporation makes its own," right? So that's socialism for these guys. It's small units doing their own thing, no collective decisions by humanity as a whole. That applies as well to socialist organization. So people might have heard of the idea of an affinity group, the anarchism of having little groups that are totally independent from each other, that you only join if you already agree with them. And if you disagree anything they do, you have to leave, and the smaller, the better. This has been troubled anarchists since their foundation. They had a debate at a conference, International Anarchist Conference in 1907, where they had to figure out, does it violate the principles of anarchy to have any organization at all. And Emma Goldman, the first anarchist, said, "I will accept anarchist organization on just one condition," said this at the conference, "that it be based on the absolute respect for all individual initiatives and not obstruct their development or evolution." Okay, so three principles I would say of anarchism: rejecting the centrality of the working class, rejecting workers taking power and engaging in politics, and rejecting centralization and favoring autonomy. So on that working class thing, I won't go over Marx's theory in detail, but the basic argument is pretty well known. Capitalism creates its own grave diggers, right? And capitalism can only exist by organizing people on a global scale and exploiting them collectively. And that means, and this is what happened, workers have led the greatest and most effective anti-capitalist struggles. And this actually led to a crisis in the anarchist movement after it was founded, because they had to reckon with the reality that while they engaged in small group politics and terrorism, workers were increasingly militant and struggling increasingly effectively against the ruling class. And so a number of anarchists broke away and formed a new current they called anarcho-syndicalism. It involved abandoning that first principle Bakunin had argued so stridently was the basis of what Marx was wrong about. Then there's rejecting politics. Bakunin said, "There does not exist any political principle capable of inspiring and stirring the masses to action." Whereas Engels, for example, so there's a debate about, you know, should socialists care about democracy, free speech, trade union rights, things like that. Engels said, "Political freedoms are our weapons. Should we fold our arms and abstain if they seek to take them away from us?" This anarchist principle also got decisively proven wrong in the decades following the foundation of the movement, because there was all these radical workers. There were some militant workers that rejected politics in the syndicalist movement, but there were also loads of radical workers that fought heroically for the right to vote, in Russia in particular, for free speech, for a constitution, things like this. Politics, in fact, and it's still the case to this day, has often led workers to engage in some of the most serious mass struggles. Okay, then there's centralization. It's an interesting way to look at things. It's been a strategic disaster, but it's also, I think, a disaster of principle. You can understand why people might be hostile to centralization. Sometimes capitalism can feel like the problem with it is centralization. We get dominated by these central powers that are so distant from us, the bosses, the cops, the state. And it can make sense to think, well, what I want is the right to do what I want without being told what to do by some external authority, right? But the problem is with capitalism, equally the problem is decentralization. We're all disconnected completely from anything we don't own. I have no say whatsoever over the fossil fuel industry because I don't own the company. I have no say whatsoever over whether vaccines are patented or whether they're free for all of humanity. It's nothing to do with me because I don't own any vaccine production companies. Really liberating humanity, providing real freedom, does actually require centralizing in a way, because you think about a really free human society, it wouldn't just mean I'm free to decide, you know, what my company does, you know, with my fellow workers. It would also mean we're all free to plan our cities together collectively, to figure out how to distribute medicine and food on a global scale, to reorganize the whole world economy, energy production collectively. And actually, decentralization is undemocratic and unfree because it robs us of the ability to influence things that don't happen immediately around us. It's a really good illustration of how it's undemocratic, actually. At our own Marxism conference in Easter, we had in Melbourne, a few anarchists came, a guy called Sam from a local anarchist group here, and he raised a hypothetical in favor of decentralization. He said, what if you have a global socialist society, right? And you have these bad American workers and they force some nice Bolivian workers to engage in environmentally destructive mining, like by centralized passing a vote, they've got the majority and they make the Bolivian workers do the wrong thing. Now, I think this reveals two things. Firstly, that classic anarchist skepticism of workers, because it's basically saying, what if we have socialism and there's no exploitation and workers still do the wrong thing? What if they don't do what I want them to do? How can I stop workers from making bad decisions that I, an anarchist, don't agree with? So you're introducing decentralization in order to stop workers having the power to make decisions that you, the anarchists, don't agree with. But also, you can just easily flip it around and say, well, you've raised the hypothetical, what if the majority want to do something bad and a minority don't? But you also say, well, what if there's a minority of workers that do want to engage in an environmentally destructive practice and the rest of the world working class don't? Well, in a decentralized system, too bad. The environmental destruction happens. There's no democratic debate. There's no collective decision making. If you want to do something, you do it. There's just autonomy, right? This applies in a political group as well. Think about it. I'm in a socialist organization. We debate stuff. We disagree all the time. But we also have political principles that bind us, and we have collective democracy. So if you're in a socialist organization and you hear, what the hell, our Brisbane branch is scabbing on a strike, doing deals with bosses, organizing anti-vaccine campaigns with a bunch of fascists. Now, I'm not saying the Brisbane branch is doing that. It's a hypothetical. So don't assume that the social, I'm saying, what if that did happen, right? If that did happen, we would be able to make a decision and say, no, 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 this contradicts our political principles. You do not have the autonomy to scab to deal with bosses or whatever. If you have a political group that elects an MP and they sell out and vote for Liberal policy and you're nice and decentralized and you honor the principle of autonomy, well, too bad. That's that. They're the MP. They're the parliamentary group. They get to make the decisions and they're autonomous and decentralized. Capitalism alienates political power into a minority. Only the centralized capitalist state can make big political decisions. But it also says everything else is the decentralized economy. Each company makes its own decisions and nobody can collectively control it. So from, I think, the correct Marxist point of view, to liberate humanity, you need to centralize society from below through working class organization, through, like Marx put it, association, revolutionary councils, democratic organization of armed workers confronting the capitalist state through their own revolutionary groups. And that is how things have developed. You know, the history of anarchism has been basically one crisis after another, dealing with these principles that prevent them from organizing effectively. They had a conference in London at one point where they had to have a debate on whether they could have any decision-making method. And they only made one decision, which was they definitely wouldn't decide anything by voting. Now, I ask you to think, how did they make that decision? Was there a point in the history of anarchism, I think there may have been, where in a meeting, someone had to say, everyone who thinks voting is an illegitimate way to make decisions, raise your hand now. And, you know, this is the kind of crisis that these people face repeatedly. In the Russian Revolution, you had the old regime fall at the start of 1917, and there was an uprising led by urban workers in the big cities and the big factories employed by the big capitalists, in contradiction to everything the anarchists would have thought. You had a new liberal capitalist government that declared itself the new authority, but you also had a massive flourishing of democratic workers' institutions from below. But against what the anarchists thought, they were very political, as well as just concerned with economic things. They wanted to end the war, oppressed nations, as well as distribute land to the peasants and achieve an 8-hour day. There were workers' councils that were developed by the working class themselves, and they were based in the factories. They debated politics, they debated economics, and they elected representatives. They were social and they were political, and they were rival power, a rival authority, just like Marx said, to that new liberal capitalist government. So anarchist opposition to power at this point was basically irrelevant. The number one question was, are these workers' committees going to take power, or are they going to leave the capitalists in power? The workers' councils had to be organized for taking power, taking up political demands so that everyone in society knew if these workers take power, then our political demands will be realized. And that had to be coordinated by working class socialist political activists, and in particular, the Bolshevik Party. So every anarchist theoretical and strategic contribution was irrelevant. Some looked at something called the factory committees in Russia. These were just local factory-based organizations that were meant to be responsible just for that one factory's issues. And anarchists liked them in theory because they were non-political, decentralized, and they would just manage factory issues. Some anarchists said that's a good solution. You disintegrate everything. Workers will manage each factory just through the factory committees, and you'll have decentralization of the economy, decentralization of eating, no politics, only committees trading with each other. Problem was, there was a massive economic crisis sweeping Russia at the time. And every worker activist who led a factory, they didn't want to run a collapsing factory buying raw materials and selling shoes. This was not the dream of socialism, especially in an economic collapse when they had to go off foraging for firewood, defending the factory from looters, figuring out how to stop, you know, starving workers stealing. Workers involved in the factory committees realized there needed to be a centralized political solution. Workers as a whole needed to take power. And from very on, the factory committee meetings and conferences passed motions calling to workers' councils to seize power and radically transform the whole economy as part of an international revolution. And when workers did seize power in 1917, some anarchists basically said, I know this contradicts every principle of anarchism, but we've got to support it, because it's the only way for the revolution to succeed. And that's true. You do have to abandon all anarchist principles in order to lead a successful workers' revolution. Others said, no, we're going to stick to anarchist principles and oppose workers taking power. And the anarcho-syndicalists prior to the revolution, when there was a debate, should workers' councils take power under the slogan, all power to the workers' councils, they passed a motion saying, inasmuch as we do not believe in a revolution which begins with a political act, that is by the taking of power, and we do not support any action of the masses for political goals, we do not support the present movement. And some anarchists stuck to their guns all the way through. And after the workers' revolution, launched a terror campaign trying to blow up the leaders of the new workers' councils and killing many of them in bombing attacks through their decentralized autonomous small group politics and trying to enforce their enlightened theories on the workers who'd made this stupid decision to seize power. So all the principles of Marxism as a strategy were vindicated. As is well known, though, they were not repeated outside of Russia. That's not because human nature shows that power corrupts. It's because outside Russia, in fact, in too many cases, people did follow anarchist advice. They didn't form serious political organizations, and workers' institutions didn't challenge for power. And since then, after the Russian Revolution, anarchists have provided all these apparently radical arguments to keep workers out of power, disorganized, and oppressed. And it's not just ancient history. Occupy Wall Street, it's the 10-year anniversary. David Graeber, the anarchist theorist who decided a lot of its decision-making methods, he said, the good thing about decentralization is it stops anyone making serious decisions and it stops democracy. He said, talking about Occupy Wall Street, you only get tepid solutions if you bring everything to the General Assembly. That's why we have working groups. Empower them to perform actions and encourage them to form spontaneously. Consensus and decentralization. The unwieldiness of finding consensus in a large group should convince people not to bring decisions before the large group. That's the way it's supposed to work out. So you're trying to split everything off, say, unless we have consensus, we can't do anything. And so then we have to have everyone in small groups doing their own thing with no democracy. There was in the 70s a conference in Sydney where they tried to unite the anarchist movement. I'll just quote a report on it from some anarchists. And I think anyone who spent time in the anarchist movement, and I have, will recognize some of this. So a report from anarchists on the Sydney conference, I think it's 1975, quote, session after session was marred by high-pitched screaming, playing of musical instruments, drinking, and continuous acrimonious opposition to the concept of a chairperson, abuse of the conference facilities, general unruly behavior and disorganization. In addition, personal threats were made, and anyone who tried to bring any order to the conference was denounced as an authoritarian, and some comrades were accused of being social fascists. People who were arguing for the anarchist movement to become involved in trade union and industrial work were accused of neglecting other forms of struggle. Wherever this position was advanced, people doing so were denounced for idolizing the working class. These disputes finally came to a head on Sunday afternoon, where most of the workers present, some students left the conference and held a successful meeting at a comrade's house. Here, the failings of the conference were discussed. So once again, anarchists had another theoretical breakthrough. More seriously, there's been a wave of revolutions, you know, since 2011 and then again since 2019, fighting against economic inequality, but also for political democracy. The problem, I would argue, is that in these revolutions, the Marxist strategy for smashing the state hasn't taken root. Those revolutions have either been defeated by a head-on attack from a centralized capitalist state, or they've been reabsorbed into society as they run out of ideas and can't organize a way to take power. No working class leadership has emerged that could really challenge that centralized power of the capitalists. It's been decentralized and it can't organize to reorganize society from below. One reason for that, I have to say, is that most self-described Marxists don't actually accept the Marxist theory of social revolution. In much of the Middle East, Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Europe and the United States, some of the best known Marxists support the exact kind of bureaucratic state that Karl Marx opposed. You have Stalinists in Syria, you have Stalinists in Hong Kong opposing mass uprising, opposing workers' democracy, opposing revolutionary struggles. In Hong Kong, if you're a radical young person fighting for the right to vote, for example, and you have the Chinese Communist Party and its activists, many of whom are big capitalists, saying to you, Karl Marx teaches us we need centralization and workers' power, and that means getting beaten by the Hong Kong police and denied the right to vote on the order of big capitalists. Well, of course, you won't look too deeply into Marxism, and you'll probably be interested in anarchism, as many young people in Asia are, and similarly in the Middle East. Marx's whole argument was that socialism can't be realized through national bureaucratic states. only through international workers' struggle. And the power of Marxist theory has meant that both dictators and reformists have used that Marxist language to justify its opposite. But the real tragedy is that leads to anarchistic strategies, consciously or unconsciously, that aren't capable of challenging capitalism, are being taken up by many activists. And that's why revolution after revolution keeps getting defeated before our eyes, as they don't form a working class socialist challenge to the state. So I think that means all up, when it comes to smashing the state, we've got two responsibilities. Number one, you've got to argue against the sham socialist in favor of Marxist theory, which is global working class revolution. We also have to argue against faux radical theories like anarchism that disorganize the oppressed and leave them helpless in the face of a capitalist counterattack. And that's it. That's the end of my argument.